You know, we may take it for granted, but it is one of the things that we're blessed with, in certainly in AA and Al-Anon as well, and that is we see people come in and make profound changes. They're very, very evident, deep changes in their lives, and it's very inspiring. And I thought I would invite our speaker this evening, Mark, to come up and share a story with you. Where's Mark? Here he is. So please welcome Mark.
Thanks, Don. So I guess you're talking about me, about making a big change. So I wonder what I was like. I think there are a lot of people here who did know me then and who know me now and can talk about that. You know, I'm Mark, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. I can count on my sponsor, Mike, Mike took me through the steps the very first time in 2010. June 14, 2010 is my sobriety date. I recognize a lot of people in here. My home group is on the waterfront. Before that, I was a hanger-oner at the Charter Denny Park group before we sort of disbanded. Honestly, I feel super unqualified to talk to you guys tonight. It's a common feeling I have when I go to a lot of things like this. But mostly for here, it's because I know that I was not nearly as bad as most of you guys. So I feel like I can speak from a point of moral high ground. But, you know, if you would have told me back when I was drinking that I was going to, you know, be at a weekend away with a bunch of guys talking about AA, I would have said, you're absolutely crazy. This is not anything like I would have planned for myself. I mean, the weekend away with the guys, sure, those were fun times. We never knew what was going to happen. You know, I looked forward to those drinking weekends. Thank you. With a mixture of excitement and fear, because I never really knew, you know, what might happen. And, you know, plenty of those weekends, you know, ended with, you know, close brushes with law enforcement, you know, wife's barely finding out about this and that or the other thing. Just a whole secret life. And I think that's a huge part of my story. And you know, it is a little nerve-wracking getting up here and talking to you guys about this. My goal tonight is to speak from the heart, tell you guys exactly, you know, what happened to me, how I got sober, how I live sober. That last one, I think, is the key and one of the hardest things, you know, for the program for me, is how do I live sober? How do I take away the option, you know, to go back out again? Because it's always on the table, you know, and it's for me, I spend a lot of time, you know, thinking about, I mean, I'm the kind of guy that wants to make sure I've got that out, you know, that, you know, that option just to say, you know what, this has been really cool hanging out with you guys, really nice to know you, but you know, I can't really do this thing. I can't do this sober thing. This is not me. You guys are having fun. You're talking about, you know, God and this sort of stuff. I mean, honestly, that option, keeping that option open is kind of part of my story. But I'm happy to say that we'll get into the details, is that, you know, the more I work the program, the more I am honest, completely honest about how I'm feeling, the more I'm able to keep that option at bay and to push it out. Because there's a lot that would go down if I took that option. You know, that's the thing about alcoholism is that we take a lot of people down with us. And you know, I've got a wife, a wonderful woman, 17 years we've been married. She's a saint after what I put her through. I'm going to get emotional, and it's not even time yet for me to do that. But, you know, and it's interesting that we have an Al-Anon meeting along with AA because, I when I was drinking and I didn't really know much about AA, or I couldn't understand how Al-Anons and AAs could get together. And, I mean, it's almost like you're on opposing sides of something, but it's now I see it. I see it. I see the pain that I put my wife through. I see the pain I put my children through, and they need help as much as I need help. So anyway, what I want to talk about, I couldn't help myself. I had to make notes about what I wanted to talk about tonight. And there's a theme that I want to have run through the whole thing, if I do it right. And that is this, for me, something I got, like everything you're going to hear tonight is stuff I've got from other people in the program, except for my own personal experience. But when it comes to these principles, it's about how it was shown to me by a lot of the people in this room, and how I show it to other people who are alcoholics. And for me, that's the key. I was given something. I was given this huge gift. I was given this ability to have a family. I was given this ability to have a productive, healthy relationship with my children, whereas I'm not supposed to have that. If you know the history, like a lot of you guys do know, I mean, the history in my family of alcoholism wasn't about healthy relationships with kids. It wasn't about loving relationships with wives. It was about, you know, damage, destruction, divorce, distance. But what I get to have now, because people in this room gave it to me, is the opportunity to live a full life with my family. And what I am required to do in order to keep that is to give it on to somebody else. And I really sincerely believe that. So the three points that I really want to stress, there's three surrender points, and they're big ones for me. And the first one is I had to surrender to the fact that I was an alcoholic. And there was a lot of debate there, a lot of wondering, you know. And it was staring me in the face the whole time. I mean, how I drank versus other people. But I wasn't ready to surrender to that idea that I was, in fact, an alcoholic. I mean, I think I drank for a lot of the same reasons everybody else drinks. I mean, I felt uncomfortable in situations. Things didn't feel quite right. You know, going to events, going to things that should be fun, you know, like hiking or you know, sports. You know, I'd want it would be a lot better if I had just a little bit of a buzz, and you know, out on dates. You know, I really drank because as soon as I had that feeling, everything became clear. Everything I hadn't, you know, I didn't have to want for anything. It seemed like, you know, and I had a whole contingency plan of, you know, how I could do anything with alcohol. Alcohol was this magic thing for me that allowed me into places I didn't feel like I was a part of. I was able to have confidence to go into that job interview with a couple, you know, hits off of the airplane bottles. I was able to be calm and say I do at my wedding with a little bit of scotch. You know, and it started, you know, in my teenage years and at high school. I went to Cascade High School in South Everett. We were state champions in 1992. Just want to put that out there, 3A. But the the 3A playoff night after the Wesco championship, me and a couple other guys thought it would be a good idea to go on top of the school roof and celebrate. So we were up there, and we had apparently triggered the silent alarm or something. And the police showed up, and they had surrounded the high school. If you've ever been up, it's kind of on that highway to Boeing. And so we saw the police sort of all assembled, ready to get us. And so we decided to try and go out the back way. And we were drunk and fell off the fence, and they were there too. And so I got a call. My mom, she was a single mom for most of her most of my upbringing, and she got a call from the policeman and saying, you know, come pick up your drunk son. And you know, she thought it was funny. It's one of these deals where we didn't really talk about the alcoholism, didn't talk about the drinking, and oftentimes I'd get a call from the bar where my mom was. She wasn't home. She was at the bar. The bartender called, and somebody needs to come and pick her up. So it was not a big deal. But I had a coach, a really influential person in my life, and he was a great coach. His name was Terry Ennis. And he sat me down and he said, and he made me feel like about that big because, you know, what I had put on the line, you know, it could have been our last game, and he was now forced to suspend us. And, you know, we had now put the whole team's future at in jeopardy. So it was my first taste of what drinking could do and how I would place something that's really important to me just right in the middle of the table, like I was playing poker or like I was just putting it on the roulette wheel. And I mean, that didn't make sense to me, but that's what I did. And that was a pattern of behavior that continued. I was fortunate to go to the best university in the United States, Washington State University. And no Cougs in the house? Where are the Cougs? Okay, thank you. I went to a I was in a fraternity, big shocker there, and I remember being so upset that this legislator in Olympia had passed some bill. It was called the Heavey Bill, that did not allow us to drink on campus. I just thought that was one of the biggest injustices. I felt like I'd go fight for my country, but I couldn't drink in my own fraternity house. But anyway, you know, drinking in college, that's all normal. You know, everybody drinks till they puke, and it didn't, you know, I mean, hey, no big deal. You know, you puke and you get going, and it's not a big deal. But the problem with me is I kept doing that, you know, and the party didn't stop for me. And at some point, it started to become more like a job than it did, it wasn't fun anymore. I became, a daily drinker. I went to law school, honestly, to keep the party going. I wasn't ready to face up to what the world might be like as a responsible adult. I wanted to keep the party going, and I did. I met my wife somewhere in there, and my fiance, and, and I think when she married me, I think she saw a project, and, you know, I was only happy to help her out in that department. She is one of the most normal drinkers you've ever seen. When I got sober, and I told her that we weren't going to I would be most comfortable if we didn't have alcohol in the house. She said, "Yeah, no problem. We don't need to have alcohol in the house." And I was like, "Wow, that is a huge deal. Thank you." You know, because I mean, if the tables were turned, there's no way I would have said we're going to have a dry house. I mean, it's like this is your deal. You know, I can. You know, but for her, I mean, that just shows you it just wasn't an issue for her. You know, she is the kind of drinker that will leave, you know, parts of alcohol in the glass. And I just couldn't understand that. She can truly take it or leave it. And she's, you know, often right about everything. And yeah, and she wants to make sure I know about it. But when I met her, I'll never forget the feeling that it was like, God, I was 21 years old, and I thought, oh shit, this is the woman I'm going to marry, and I'm just not done partying yet, you know, this is really bad timing. But I could tell that was like absolutely the woman that I was going to marry, you know, and she was. And I knew eventually it would have to stop, you know, the drinking would have to stop. She came to me and she said, we were married for 4 years, and she said, it's about time we have a family. And I thought, okay, perfect. You know, all I need to do is, you know, you can stop the birth control, and then we'll have a baby, and then you'll take care of the baby, and I'll continue working, and that'll all be fine, right? It was like, I didn't think I was really going to be necessarily that involved with the child. So I was like, sure. So if you want to have a baby, that's no problem. But that's not how it worked out. And when that, you know, baby was born, it was, I can never quite, you know, describe the feeling of mixture of love, for that baby. But this desire to, you know, continue that pursuit, you know, it's like this, you can't describe, I mean, I can describe it. You guys have all felt it, you know, it's this conflict. You know, I love that kid, but at the same time, it was really cramping my style, you know, I took up golf at that point in time because that was my excuse to drink continuously all day, you know. That's why I kind of had to laugh when the deal was we were going to meet at Gold Mountain, because I used to love to play 36 holes at Gold Mountain and drink all day long. I always made sure someone else drove. I had a almost 1-year-old baby, and I'm still running and gunning like I was in college. And I remember one time in particular coming home. I remember being in a blackout and getting into a cab. And I remember the cab driver getting very upset with me because I had lost my wallet. I had asked him to stop by the gas station. Who knows, probably to buy more alcohol. And so he did, and then that's when I realized I had lost my wallet. And so he had driven me from downtown Seattle. At that time, we lived in Bothell. And so he was somewhere, you know, in between. And I had told him I can't pay him, you know. And wow, he was really upset. And so I, you know, the old football days came back, and I, you know, did a couple jukes this way and that way and was able to run away from him. And I hid under this car, and he was looking for me, and he was he was really angry. And I hid under that car for a long time, and it was cold. And I remember in a moment getting away and walking through a neighborhood that was nearby, and it's like 2:00 in the morning, and I'm knocking on people's doors seeing if they can tell me, because I didn't know where I was. I didn't have you know. And then what am I doing? I'm a father, and this is not normal behavior. finally got back to the gas station and called my wife to come pick me up, and she came and had to wake the baby up, and she came and to pick me up. And that was, I felt lower than low at that point. She had a discussion with me that really hurt, and it was, you know, how she told me, now that we've had a child, that she had hoped that, you know, I would be step up and be, you know, sort of the leader, the man of the house, if you will. She's a very traditional woman, but she's not going to accept this kind of behavior from me. And she asked me, she said, she kind of thought when we had a baby that she was, that I was going to step up. And she said, you haven't. And she said, I can't even leave the children with you. By that point, I had driven the car drunk with the baby just done really despicable things. So it all came to a head in 2005 the first time. And I went to WSU homecoming, which I think a lot of people get sober after that if they're about 32-ish and they're heading back in a motorhome like I did. We went to a homecoming, and I remember driving home in the motorhome with the guys, and I was the only guy still drinking, you know, in the morning, you know, vodka, trying to sort of still the nerves a little bit. And some of the guys were like, you know, hey, are you doing okay? And, you know, a little concerned about what was going on. Got home. And at that point, my wife said, you know, this is it. You know, you've got to do something. That was October 16th of 2005. So I just went online and I'm like, I need to find the quickest, easiest thing to deal with this. I thought, you know, Schicksal sounded great. 10 days and I'll get my life back. Deal. That's a deal. So I went to the Schicksal place, and they were actually pretty honest with me, and they said, you know, this is not going to be lasting sobriety for you unless you pair it with some kind of other program. And I remember getting there, and I remember they said, you know, you're an alcoholic. You can't drink ever again. I'm kind of like, whoa, ever again? That's not what I came here so that, I mean, what about one at a barbecue or like some nice wine when I, you know, go to France or something like that? She's like, they're like, no, you're an alcoholic. And so I wasn't ready to hear that. But I left, I did 10 days of that program. I came back. I felt so good. For the first time physically, I was on a high because I had, I was dry. And I thought, wow, this is the answer. I mean, I remember thinking, and I remember someone said, you know, maybe you should go to AA now. I'm like, I don't need AA. This is like, I go, George Bush, you know, he was sober. He didn't need AA. Like, I can do it like George Bush did, you know, like that's what I'm going to do. You know, he was my hero, but, he wasn't my hero, but I did think about like his story, the sort of mythical party guy who became president and who, you know, decided to give up his drugs and booze, his demons. He was able to conquer them, and that was what I was going to do. But I was really, really sure everybody in my family knew what a thing I was doing for them, right? You know, that, you know, and they would say, hey, we're gonna have a party. It's going to be awesome. We're all going to go. I'm like, you guys go. I can't, you know, I've got the drinking thing. I'm just going to, you know, I'll be good. You guys go have fun. I don't need to be there. You know, it's just, I'll just hang out here and fold clothes, you know? So no, I'm good. So I kind of wore it like this badge, and I wasn't happy. I just wasn't happy. And then lo and behold, this, guy I used to party with in high school, he was now, a painter, like a house painter. And he was doing some work on my house, and I noticed he had partied so hard that his heart stopped, and so he had this like implantable defibrillator. And I started asking him some questions about that, like, you know, what's the deal with that defibrillator thing? And he's like, well, you know, it goes off if I have an issue, you know, and keeps my heart beating at a certain rhythm. And I said, does it hurt? He's like, yeah, it hurts. And he's like, I got painkillers for that. And I was like, ooh. Painkillers. Sounds interesting. That sounds really interesting. It's like, what exactly kind of painkiller are you talking about? He's like, I take methadone. And I'm like, okay, well, what's it like? You know, what's that like? He's like, well, I could, you know, give you some if you want to know. And I said, I want to know. I want to know. And so here I was, I took that pain pill, and I was like, oh yeah, it's on, baby. It is on. 'Cause nobody could tell, you know, and I thought I had found an answer, because it didn't smell. It was just perfect, you know, The only thing is I couldn't do a bowel movement for like 2 weeks. Other than that, that's a small price to pay. A very small price to pay. Before you knew it, I needed more and more of that stuff. And I would start making appointments to see how many you got, you know. And I started just taking them on the weekends so that I could, you know. Then I thought, you know, geez, it's going to be, you know, my wife's gone. I got to have the kids all to my own tonight. So I better pop one of these to, you know, just kind of have that right little buzz so I can, hey, you want to do like all of the Dr. Seuss books, like from start to finish? Let's do it. It's on, you know. And here I am, and, you know, this supposedly successful lawyer in a downtown high-rise scheduling a drop of pills from my dealer, and I remember I got the cash out, and in my suit I'm, you know, walking down, you know, take the elevator down. Hey, how you doing? Yes, oh yeah, yeah, got a big case, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I gotta go to court or something, but I gotta stop by here just a little bit and get something, yeah. Guy drives by, and I, you know, give him the money, and he gives me the pills, you know, neatly wrapped up in the cellophane that is like, you know, cigarette like packaging and some painter's tape, and just like, you know, really nice presentation. But I got what I needed, and I took those pills, that was my answer for a few months. But it was just a few months before my mind started to think about alcohol, and that since the pills were working so well, why not alcohol, you know? So and I had kept since Schicksal, I had an aversion to alcohol, so I, you know, it didn't faze me. I kept some in, you know, I wanted to be a gracious host. I kept some in my house for when guests came by, but I knew exactly how much was there. I knew, like, you know, exactly where the level of Bombay Sapphire gin was. It was just above the B, just a little bit above the B. And I knew, and that sound it would make when somebody would bump into it, I'm like, oh yeah, I hear that jingling. But I started thinking about that alcohol that was down there, and I started to experiment a little bit with it. And, you know, I remember one day, my wife and I had a date night, and she was singing at Mass at church, and so she went ahead, and I waited for the sitter to get there, but she was ahead sort of to practice, and then I would come right when Mass started. It was a Saturday evening Mass, and so I went there, and I had made sure I had a couple toots off the old gin beforehand, and again, you know, I'm drinking in secret now. She has no idea that all any of this is going on, and We got in the car and headed to the restaurant on Capitol Hill, and she said something like, did you switch aftershaves or something? I'm like, yeah, that's it. I switched aftershaves, that's right. And we had, you know, the interesting thing is we had just a wonderful dinner that night. It was like we were connecting. We were, there were no barriers, you know. We were just, you know, it felt, you know, the love was there. And so it made it all the more painful when I had, you know, about a week later, a really big debauch, you know, that ended. It was my last drink. She said, when, you know, in the aftermath of that, she said, you know, that night where that was so wonderful, were you drunk then? I was like, yeah, you know. And it was so confusing because, it was like, you know, it gave me that thing I needed, you know, and she was confused because she preferred me that way, you know. So it's just such a sick disease, you know, because here's this thing that causes so much pain and so much, you know, wreckage, but yet here it was providing this very critical lubricant for, you know, our relationship to continue. So I was completely baffled at that point about what alcohol was. But at that point I decided to check in to a treatment facility in California. That was June 14th, 2010. And, you know, I was ready at that point. I had we had switched law firms, and it was I had joined this new firm that was based in New York, and I was traveling a lot to New York, and alcohol was a big part of that. And you know, I called up my new boss and said to him that you know, and guess what? I've got this issue. And he had only known me for about 2 months because we had merged firms. And they were very supportive, and they said, you know, go for it. And, you know, I took that time off, and I went into treatment. You know, so that was kind of this second surrender. So I talked about that first surrender, sort of convincing myself that I'm an alcoholic. I was able to surrender to the idea that I was an alcoholic because I was able to see how I drank after that period of being dry for about 4 years. And it was worse than I had remembered. And I think maybe because I was trying to do it in secret and to keep it, you know, in these windows of time when I had nobody else around, that I would just go overboard. And I could tell at that point that I have a serious problem. I'm an alcoholic, and maybe I still have my family, and maybe I still have my job, but you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I was convinced by that. So that was that. You know, it felt good to surrender to this idea that I'm an alcoholic. I went into treatment, and I, you know, not like it was the first time where I was trying to say, you know, hey, this is not something that I'm really that into, or can I learn how to drink? Just sometimes I was just like, okay, I'm ready. I'm an alcoholic. What do I need to do, you know, so that this is not a problem for me? So that was a huge deal. I know, Don, you wanted me to tell the Santa story, but I kind of skipped over that part. So, yeah, no, we're not going to tell that one. No. So, you know, that was, you know, I was at step one. You know, I'd come to believe I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable, and I was ready to figure out what was it going to take to get well. When I got to treatment, you know, it was sort of introduced to me for the first time. And I have to say that before I went to AA for the first time, there was this guy I had met who gave me a big book, and I remember thinking, what does this guy think? Like, who is he think he's giving me a big book? Like, that, how presumptuous is that? Like, I told him that I don't drink, and now he thinks he's going to give me a big book. Like, he thinks that I need this big book. It's like, that's not something that, you know, I was just like, wow, this guy is, how dare he do that, you know? And as it turns out, on my last drunk, he was, you know, I knew I was in trouble that last drunk because I was supposed to be taking care of my son, and he was 3 years old at the time. And I had put him up to go take a nap. And it was a June day, and it was in 2010. We had a string of just like rainy, rainy weather, and it was like this first really nice day in June. You know those, you know, people from Seattle, you know those June days, right? When you're finally so happy the sun is shining. And I was by myself, and I had some vodka stashed pretty much everywhere. But like, I thought, I'm going to take this opportunity. I know he's going to be out for like 3 hours. I'm just going to, you know, mix myself a nice drink. I went into the refrigerator to see what we had. We had some Squirt, vodka and Squirt. That actually is surprisingly quite tasty. And I mixed that up, and ooh, that went down so well. And the sun, took my shirt off, and felt the sun on my white skin, and I was just like, I played a little bit of music, and life was very, very good. And so I thought I'd have another. And you know the rest of the story. Before you know it, I've worked myself about 2/3 the way through that bottle. I always bought the plastic because it didn't make noise when you hit it places, and it was cheaper. And so I knew I was in trouble that night. So I wasn't going to call Big Book guy. No way was I calling that guy. But I needed help of some sort. So I called this guy who was a college roommate of mine who lived in Magnolia. I lived in Queen Anne. And I hadn't talked to this guy in 2+ years. And I'm calling him up, and he could tell that I'm in big trouble. He came right over to get me, and he stayed with me until my wife came home. My wife immediately called Big Book Guy, and he came right over. I remember I was in a blackout, but like in, you know that in and out of a blackout kind of thing where you have snippets of memory. Well, one of them I remember just telling this guy, like, come on, you know you want a drink. Come on. And then, like, hold on, I'm going to go get sick, you know. And but he was so stoic, and he was on a 12-step call, that guy. And so every birthday, I call up those two guys, and I say, you know, thank you. You were there on that kind of fateful night. And I, you know, I owe a lot to them, and they're part of my story forever. And I hope I don't have another couple people like that in my life that I have to worry about thanking on an annual basis. But he told my wife at that point that I was this time bomb, and that that if she didn't do something about it, then he happened to be an ER doctor, which came in quite handy that night. But he told her, you know, kind of frankly, that this is, you know, he said something like, you know, be prepared. You know, he could lose his job. He could do this. But all that's not important. What's important is for him to get sober. So I went into that treatment center, and they started to introduce this idea from the Big Book that there are these steps. I thought, okay, well, that's interesting, you know, steps and whatnot. And the second step was, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I'd always sort of believed in some sort of higher power, but I, you know, didn't necessarily trust that the higher power could do anything for me. I thought maybe I lacked some kind of gene or something that allowed people to just give it up. I mean, who wouldn't want to just give up their life to somebody else? Like all your troubles, all your worries. I mean, God, I'm in. But, like, I couldn't do it. You know, I just couldn't do it. And then a couple things happened that sort of, you know, were kind of further evidence that there was a higher power working in my particular life. And that if I knew that there was a higher power that was particularly watching out for me, then I thought maybe, you know, I could trust this, this higher power could restore me to sanity. And these sort of things happen in little coincidences, and I had a couple of those at my treatment center. The first was this guy came to speak, much like this kind of situation. First exposure I had to an AA meeting, and I'm like, so is this how this works? Some guy gets up and talks, where you kind of sit down, and it looked, it was almost exactly like this. And he got up there and started talking. And I started to think, gosh, this guy looks really, really familiar. And as it turns out, he was a lawyer from Seattle, and he had been a lawyer on the very, very first case that I had any kind of adversarial contact with another lawyer. And I think, are there some lawyers in the room? You know, the kind of situation where it's like, you know, you're going to go meet some other lawyer and whose job is to make you look bad, or his job is to find all the faults in your arguments and in your position. And I was like a brand spanking new lawyer, one of the partners said, go out and meet with this guy and figure out what's going on. Well, I was so nervous, and I remember being physically ill. I was so nervous, and I remember having to calm my nerves with some alcohol in order to take that meeting. Feeling like such a loser, and how am I going to do this? How can I possibly have this job, this career, when I can't even sit across the table from somebody and have a conversation with them about my position without almost getting ill and having to drink? Well, it turns out, you know, I got down to treatment, and it was that lawyer. He was in treatment, and he had, you know, and he told this wonderful, this, you know, tragic story of his life and how he, you know, had gone so far down, he'd lost his family and everything. And he was basically living around in sober housing near the treatment center. So that was coincidence number one, that sort of like, wow, this is a little too close to home. And then another coincidence happened. I I got back to my little dormitory, and they gave me a slip of paper that said, Judge Heavey called. And I thought, why is Judge Heavey calling me here at treatment? But, you know, here he was. And as it turns out, the first judge I'd ever won any kind of major motion in front of was my first sponsor. So another coincidence. So those were the kinds of things that allowed me to let a higher power into my life. You know, in some ways, I relied on the group as a higher power. You know, it was this group of people who had been down this road before. I had heard tremendous stories of recovery, and I could see with my own eyes that they were well. And that was a huge showing to me that if they can do it, I could do it. So in some ways, I relied on my family as the higher power. They certainly were one of the main reasons why I was trying to get my life together. And, you know, that was a huge deal for me. Some ways I relied on my employer as my higher power because my job was important and I couldn't do my job if I didn't get sober. So, you know, in the big book, I kind of put this quote in here. In the chapter on working with others, it says, if the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. So that was made emphatic to me from the very, very beginning. And that was such a huge weight off of my shoulders when I understood that I didn't have to have anybody's conception of God but my own. And so I started right then and there to sort of form my conception of God, and it was formed through discussions with lots of people in AA, my sponsor, you know, other guys, and this idea that there's a power greater than me that's going to restore me to sanity. But, like, you know, was I insane? I mean, I couldn't really see that I was insane. I mean, that sounds a little extreme, but, you know, but... And if you guys are into Chuck C, he talks about this dirty glass full of dirty water. Take out the dirty water and the glass is still dirty. And that's what I felt like, you know. Another way to say it, there's a hole in the soul. I felt like what I was doing is I was trying to fill up this emptiness with alcohol. The other way that I've heard people say it in here is, you know, you got an alcoholic, you take out the alcohol, and sometimes you're left with the ick. And that's a little bit like I felt. So that's insane. You know, I don't think God makes garbage, you know. I don't think, you know, but that's how I felt. And I think that's insane, you know. So, yeah, I was insane. And I had this belief that God could restore me to sanity. But what I found through my own experience is that open-mindedness was a critical key to this step. As soon as I closed myself off because of prejudice, because of the way I was brought up, you know, I was lucky. We didn't really brought up in any kind of real religious way. But I know I've worked with guys who have that, and what I tell them is, you know, it's the, you know, open-mindedness is absolutely the key. And you cannot close yourself off to any conception. But what I was prone to, even though I didn't have a real strong religious background, I became Catholic, by the way, because they had the best parties. And my wife was Catholic, and they drank, and I was like, hey, sweet, I'll be Catholic. You know, it's like, why not? You know? But intellectualizing the God part was a trap that I fell into. A real helpful thing for me in this step was, you know, resigning from the debating society, trying to figure out why it works or how it works or who the God is. Is it a woman or a man? Is it a being? Is it in everything? It's like, no. You know, I just had to stop all of those questions and, you know, reading there's an infinite amount of literature on this spirituality and religious stuff, and it's like too much information. Whereas all I really needed to do were some real simple steps, and these two books right here, you know, staying focused on those was a real important part of my recovery. The other thing is faith is the result of results. And I heard that from, hope I didn't take your thunder from Sunday night on this, because I heard this from my good friend Alex. Faith is the result of results. Most of the things I'm saying here are things I've heard from you guys. But I believe it. You know, I can look across, I can look at people and see their incredible stories, see their recovery. And I know that they're, you know, the only way that can happen is through something extra human, something not human. So faith is the result of results. And that's this second surrender. So I surrendered first to the idea that I was an alcoholic. And I surrendered second to the idea that this program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. And that it produces results. It makes sober people. And it makes sober happy people, which is important. You know, so... And finally, I think this step two for me has been about acceptance, accepting that the universe is its way and I'm not in charge of it. It's going to happen the way it's going to happen, and it's a letting go type thing. It's an accepting that there is some order to this universe too for me, and that I, you know, don't have the ability to rearrange things. It's just not something that I'm allowed to do. So that's another key piece. So then I found myself at step three, and that was I made a decision to turn my will, my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. Now this was a counterintuitive step for me. I'd always been taught that, you know, carpe diem, you know, you better seize the day. If you don't, someone else will. You know, you better. You know, this whole idea, the last finish first, that sounds like idiocy. You know, I'm not going to, you know, wait around. I'm going to make things happen. And, you know, I think I was one of five kids, single mom. You know, we didn't have a lot growing up. And I knew I had to fight for everything. And I fought. I fought for everything. But you know what I found out is that was the major issue, was this ambition, this need to win. You know, that was tearing me down. I mean, it created just so much frustration and disappointment that it was something that I need to do something about. So I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. What that meant for me at the very first was to actually get on my knees and say the third step prayer, which I did with my sponsor. And it made me also find a way to do it every single day, because it's a decision I have to make. It's an action step for me that I have to make every single day. And it's an act of humility. It's an act of understanding that I'm not in control of any particular situation, that I'm going to make this decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. You know, and what it also tells me is that this alcoholism thing is really a disease of perception. It's, you know, what's wrong with the situation is really what I choose to see wrong in it. You know, and Chuck C. talks about this new pair of glasses, having a new outlook on life, this new outlook on something that would normally spin me completely out of control at work or in a relationship, to understand that I could actually turn that over. That's just a wonderful thing. But it's a daily practice. You know, page 100, with working with others, it says, when we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. That was something that was read to me one of the very first days that I started working on the big book with my sponsor, and it's amazingly true. I'm not going to tell you that it doesn't mean material success or wealth. It doesn't mean that I'm going to have 49 virgins or anything. I don't know. It means that I'm going to be happy and content in my life just the way it is. And I'm going to find a way to do that. I'm going to find a way to have a different outlook on life. I'm going to find a way to perceive life for what it really is and not this warped, distorted view of things that I had as an alcoholic and that I continue to have in sobriety if I don't do something about it. When I wake up every day with an untreated condition of alcoholism, and it's about how I look at things. It's about how I see things, about how I choose to see things. I choose to see the negative in everything if I don't do something about it. I choose to see how I'm getting screwed here if I don't do something about it. You know, that's exactly where I go. It's like, you know, something's up here. I think I'm getting screwed. That's really, you know, and then no, I'm, you know, let's just turn it over. In the 12 and 12, page 34 to 35, it says, the effectiveness of the whole AA program will depend on how well and earnestly we have tried to do step three. That says a lot. The whole the effectiveness of the whole AA program depends on how well and how earnestly we have tried to do step three. So that's hugely true for me. And what I end up doing about that is I end up saying every morning a third step prayer. I do it on my knees because somebody told me to, you know, and because it feels weird. And it's, you know, I don't know. And I don't know who I'm praying to. But for once, do something that is, you know, not your idea. You do something that is not, you know, AA in a lot of ways is about getting uncomfortable. It's about doing that thing that I always tried to avoid, talking straight with people, telling them honestly how I felt about something. You know, that's what AA is about. That's hard to do. But when you actually do it, you feel so much better. So why is it that we do things that make us feel bad? Why is it, you know, when the right choice in the end, in the long term, feels better? I don't know. But for me, the willingness to do that is the key. It needs to be done daily for me. It needs to be as complete as I can make it, not just the alcohol problem. And I need to accept help from others. So after that, I found myself at step four. My sponsor again told me about the three S's: safety, security, sex. And underlying all of these are fear. So when I went through my four step, I was able to see that these are all about instincts. These are about safety. Everybody wants to feel safe. It's about security. Everybody wants to feel, you know, secure. You got to have sex, you know. I mean, that's just sort of, you know, that's the way it works. So, but these things, when they're out of control, when they're misused, as alcoholics tend to do, you start to feel like you're a bad person. But what I realized going through the four step is I'm just a squirrel trying to get a nut, you know. I'm just trying to survive. And it's not like I'm a bad person. 12 and 12, it says on page 43, we want to find out exactly how, when, and where our natural desires have warped us. We wish to look squarely at the unhappiness this has caused others and ourselves. Then it says again on page 44, instincts on rampage balk at investigation. I love that quote. And, you know, that's what the four steps about, looking at how my instincts, my particular instincts, my experience with these really boils down to those three S's. You know, what has happened as a result of me indulging in those instincts. I wrote out, you know, five columns. In the big book on page 65, they've got the columns. They've got three of those columns. I added on there the defect that was triggered, you know, by a resentment I may have had with somebody. and then my part in it. So five columns, and then I listed my fears. On page 68, it talks about that. And then I had a sexual inventory. Now, page all the sex stuff is on page 69, just FYI. And then it says, talks about future sex life and how we tried to shape a sound ideal for our future. One of the reasons I like men's groups, I know some people in the back here want me to talk about sex a little bit. It's, you know, one of these issues that, I mean, I think it's remarkable that they even address this in the big book in the 30s. But, for me personally, it became the substitute for alcohol in many, many ways. And through sobriety, finding ways to act out in that way, dogged me in a major, major way. It's something that I had to get honest with a sponsor about. It's something that, we're only as sick as our secrets, which is the step five process. Talking to somebody else about these sort of things has been hugely helpful. But it's something that I had to watch, and I have to continuously watch, because it's one of these things that can, for me personally, take me from point A to point B, like a hit of cocaine or something like that. It's just like, and all of the scheming, all of the planning, it's the same type of addict behavior I had around pills and around alcohol. But it had just the same amount of ability to ruin my life. So it's something they told me, that my counselor in treatment told me to watch out for that. And I thought he was crazy, because I'd never thought that I would have any kind of issue with that. But there's this thing called the internet that is, it sort of lays everything out for you. And if you have an issue with that, I want you to come talk to me, because one of the things that helps me stay clean in that regard is to talk to other people about it. So I know that's why I like men's meetings. I'm sure women have it too. I guess they have it. But, it's not something you want to talk, I guess, to a woman about necessarily. But anyway, that brings me to step six, which is entirely willing to give up these character defects. And that was one I was hanging on to. That was my little thing, It's like, I gave up drinking, I can be honest, but, come on, I need some me time. This is my thing. This is not hurting anybody. It's a transaction. It's two willing people. But no, it's one of the most soul damaging activities that we can do, that I can do. It was very much like the drinking and the drugs. But I had this idea, and when it came to step six, I had this idea that I was going to hold on to this one, that, it wasn't necessarily one I was gonna give up, or I was ready to give up. But the way I looked, the way I came to look at it, was that the addict was like this. And this is another thing I'm stealing from a guy in my men's group. I go to a men's group on Tuesdays and Fridays with some guys in the room, and you'll recognize who this comes from. But he says there's an amoeba inside of me that is my addict. And it's trying to find any kind of crack, because, I could keep this sex stuff secret. I'm not going to spend so much money where I'm going to go bankrupt. I'm not going to get caught, but it's an amoeba that's going to find a crack, and it's going to say, I'm not going to get Mark to drink today or do drugs, but I'm going to get him to do this. And then it's got me, right? And then the cascade of things, wife finds out. Again, she did find out. That's a whole other story. I would be done if that happened. It's putting my wife, my children, everything I hold most important in the roulette, put it on black and just spin the wheel. That's what I was doing. And it's just crazy in sobriety doing that. But at step six, it's really being honest with myself about, am I really willing to give this up? And what helped is for me to understand that this will kill me. It will get me back to drinking, because drinking is the thing that I know will kill me. The pills I probably could have done without, you know, if I would have had like an enema or something, I would have been perfect. Then I could have dealt with that problem. But the sex stuff would eventually kill me, because I would get found out, I would lose that my status, I would lose my wife, and I would drink over that. I would surely drink over that, and then I would die. So it's a serious thing. It's an amoeba trying to find a crack inside of me, trying to kill me. That's what that is. So then I'm at step seven, you know, another action step. Again, I got to take that daily. When I say my third step, I say a seventh step, and the focus is on humility. From the 12 and 12 at page 71, 72, it says, "Never was there enough of what we thought we wanted. We lacked the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values had to come first, and that material satisfactions were not the purpose of living." Whoa, that's some pretty hefty spiritual stuff right there. That material satisfactions were not the purpose of living. That goes against everything I've ever been taught, and everything you see on TV. But it's absolutely 100% the truth. We wanted more. I wanted more than I was entitled. And I thought that my happiness could be manipulated. My happiness could be delivered to me if I just did certain things. That I was in charge of my own well-being and peace and happiness. That the material world was in charge of that. I found that to be false. That doesn't bring... And that's a real humbling thing. That's what step seven is. It's realizing that these things that are dogging me, I have absolutely no ability to do anything about them. It's going to take another act of grace, another higher power to do something about it. So I get on my knees and I say a prayer. At 12 and 12, it says, page 72, "We never thought of making honesty, tolerance, and true love of man and God the daily basis of living." We never thought about that, you know. And when you're living in your defects, when I'm living in my defects, step six, I'm not making honesty, tolerance, and true love of man and God the daily basis of living. I'm that squirrel trying to get a nut, and it's trying to, it's not something that I can flip a switch on. It's something that takes. It's like water on a stone. Over time, it gets less and less. Step eight, I did that, listed out, all the people I had harmed. On, page 80, the 12 and 12, it says, "We might next ask ourselves what we mean when we say we've harmed other people." You know, I had a pretty narrow definition of what harm was, when I went into this the first time. And I had to go back and relook at that. And understand that, you know, my instincts had collided in a pretty big way with lots of other people. So I took a broader view of who I had harmed. And luckily, a lot of those people were on my four-step list. And I could go back and revisit that. So a lot of people like to burn that list after they give it. But, you know, I think it's helpful to keep it somewhere safe. And because you're going to need it in step eight. Step nine was something I had to do with a sponsor. You know, this was a you know, I did all the normal ones. You know, my wife. You know, my parents. The ones who were closest to me, I tended to hurt the most through my drinking. The hardest, though, amends were some I had to make to my former boss. I had a situation where I had a case that was accepted for cert at the U.S. Supreme Court, and my boss was in New York, and as soon as cert was granted, he called me up and said, you know, good job, Mark. We'll take it from here, basically, is what he said. And I thought, you know, the hell you will. You know, this is my case. I've been working it the whole time. And now that there's some national attention on it, you're going to take this. So I really got riled up. And I remember I called Mike, and he said, Mark, your ego is not your amigo. And that was good advice. Really good advice. But I did not take it. That was good for, you know, but this was serious. You know, come on. Jesus. You know? So I plotted, and I had, you know, how I could keep him out of it, I wrote fake memos for him to read. I did. And so I made sure that he was totally out of the loop. I manipulated, you know, everything so that I got a chance to argue that case. And I look back at that now, and it's kind of regretful. But I had an opportunity to make an amends to this guy. I mean, it was really dickish of him to sort of come in and say, you know, I'm going to take the case. And so I would have been justified to do what I did, right? Because I was just, you know. But, you know, I had to do a step 9 on that. And I had to actually, you know, he's got all sorts of reasons for me to be upset with him other than this. And so, but I had to forget all of that. Step 9 is not about all of that. Step 9 is about what I did in that particular situation. And I was not going to be free of that until I came clean and was honest with him about that and said I was sorry. It helped that he was pretty drunk at the time I did it. But but anyway, I don't even know if he remembers I did it. But anyway, I did it. And that's, you know, step 9, these are opportunities for growth in the program. Don't waste them. You know, that's all I could say is when you're new and you've got a chance, sit down with a sponsor and, you know, because when it's done right, it is one of the more powerful experiences of the program. And you can experience these promises that happen in the ninth step. So that's what I got to say about that. Step 10, I continued to take personal inventory. When I was wrong, promptly admitted it. For me, this has become an annual house cleaning that I do at this retreat I go on with these guys that I do a men's group with. It's about emotional sobriety. It's about recognizing if I'm feeling a little off and I know there's something wrong with me, there's something wrong with my program. If I'm not seeing things like in a way, if I'm seeing them that warped way that I tend to do, then it's a 10th step time, and I talk to somebody else about it. So I do these spot check inventories, but then I do an annual house cleaning, and I have at least for the last 3 years, where I've had some reasons, some real reasons to do that, and that's been a savior for me. But, you know, keeping that mind clean is important. You know, we're only as sick as our secrets. We're only, you know, if I'm holding a resentment against somebody, that's not healthy. I'm going to drink again. That's the way it works. It's I've seen it over and over again. So that's what the 10th step is there for. Prayer and meditation. What I found is there was no specific way to do this. I have done it in a variety of ways. I run a lot, getting into a rhythm and exercise has been a really strong meditation for me. I pray throughout the day. You know, and again, I don't know who I'm praying to, or I'm not saying any particular words. I'm just saying, you know, I'm just asking for help most of the time with any kind of situation, and I'm turning things over constantly. Stressful situations at work, you know, before you get up and talk to a bunch of people you don't know, or you turn it over. You can do a lot of things when you get good at prayer. You know, you can do just about anything if you can truly, truly pray and turn things over. That's what I found. lastly, step 12, working with others. So three things. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, that tells me that I'm going to have a spiritual awakening if I do the steps. That's a pretty good deal. And it tells me that the way I have a spiritual awakening is actually doing the steps. I tried to carry the message to other alcoholics, and that has been one of the great joys of recovery for me, is the opportunity to give it back to somebody else. It says, you guys know, I've told you I've had this issue with the sex stuff sort of dogging me in recovery. And it says, in the big book, that if that's a real big problem for you, then you throw yourself all the more into helping others. And I'd say about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I decided I was going to make a concerted effort to start sponsoring. And I did. And since then, I've had such a remarkable relief from that particular issue. And maybe it's a coincidence that it happened at the same time. I don't think so. I think the book says right there that if you throw yourself into working with others, if this is a particular problem for you, you throw yourself into working with others. And I mean, that's been my experience, is as soon as I started sponsoring guys, that particular issue got a lot better, and I haven't had a slip in that area for a couple years. So, it's a real deal. It's it works, and I'm just incredibly grateful that I have an opportunity to live this way. I think about my grandfather, falling over drunk after making the family dinner, and my grandmother dutifully propping him up at the head of the table, only to have him fall over again. And I'm glad I'm not that guy. And I think, he ran himself into the canless sign on his way home to Ballard, 1950-something, and almost died. And, I know that that put, my dad and his brothers and sisters through just torture. And I know from my own childhood what it was like. Wasn't to the extreme it was for my dad, but it was bad. And I don't, my kids don't have to put up with that. I've got four wonderful children. I got a 12-year-old. I've got a 10-year-old, and my 4-year-old and 2-year-old have never seen me drink, and I hope they never will. So thanks.